So here's the question. In the print and packaging supply chain, how do we deliver new ideas and innovative practices to continually improve your profit, your brand, and your quality? Welcome to the Gamut Podcast, and I am your host, Jeff Collins, Director of Print Technologies for ID Alliance. We are a nonprofit global think tank serving the graphic communications industry with 12 offices strategically located around the world to better support our membership. You can support the Gamut Podcast and content like this by becoming a member at ID Alliance by going to www.idalliance.org. I would also like to thank Konica Minolta for sponsoring this podcast. They are a world leader in industrial and commercial printing and packaging solutions. On today's Gamut Podcast, we have an individual that has over 60 patents under his belt, and he is Jan Morovic from HP Barcelona, and he has been at HP Barcelona since 2003, focusing on all aspects of color management, calibration, you name it. He's involved in it with HP's wide format solutions. And Jan publishes articles and writes on a variety of topics at his own blog at wonderverse.home.blog. Again, that's wonderverse.home.blog. Check it out. And we'll touch on one of those articles later on in the podcast today. Jan, thank you so much today for joining us on the Gamut Podcast.
Thank you for the invitation. I've had a look at some of your previous podcasts. It's really a great collection.
That's quite an honor coming from you, Jan, and we really appreciate those kind words.
Thanks very much to you, Jeff. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I look forward to the chat with you.
And where are you talking to me from today?
So I'm in England right now. I work for HP in Barcelona in Spain, but I do so remotely from England. I spend about half my time here and half at the office.
And Jan, for our listeners, can you tell us what your role is at HP?
So I'm a master technologist at HP, and I'm a senior color scientist. And what I do is I try to make sure that what we offer our customers in terms of color across the large format printing portfolio makes sense and addresses their needs and lets them get on with doing their work as easily and as efficiently as possible and delivering really good looking prints with accurate color.
And what are some of the key solutions that you work on? Are they proofing systems, HP Indigo, wide format inkjet, or possibly all of the above?
Mm-hmm. So the printers that we develop in Barcelona are all for commercial or industrial use, and we have sort of three product lines. We have the DesignJet printers, where some of them are meant for technical printing, like printing architectural engineering drawings, GIS maps, while others are for graphics, for fine art, photography, graphic design, and also used in proofing, as you mentioned before. Yeah. Then we have the latex product line. These are printers for printing a variety of signage, things like vehicle wraps, building wraps, billboards, posters, point of sale, etc., both for indoor and outdoor applications. And then the most recent product line we have are the Stitch series printers, and these are for textile printing, initially for dye sublimation onto polyester fabrics, but it's a first step into a new market.
I would love to know what a master technologist and senior color scientist for HP does in a typical day or a week.
Well, you start the day with coffee, like everybody else, right?
Yes.
and then, my role really is kind of sits between a great variety of other disciplines and experts in a variety of fields. So I work with colleagues who develop the printheads and the inks, who are mostly based in the US on the West Coast. Then I also interact with colleagues from marketing, from customer assurance, and then a variety of different kind of experts in research and development, all with the objective of both keeping up to date with where the needs are that our customers have in terms of color, and with how technology develops that we can use to address those needs. And some of that will be technology coming from our partners. We work with a great variety of companies, both in terms of hardware and software vendors, and then a lot of technology developed by ourselves. And in particular, in the context of color, it's an area where we believe that we have a strong track record of introducing new solutions that lets us differentiate also against our competitors. So what I try to do here is to really connect the dots, to make sure that what we develop makes sense for our customers. Also, our colleagues in marketing can present it and messages and sell it clearly, so that not only do we improve the way that color can be managed, but also that our customers know about it easily and can use it without having to learn a lot of new things.
And you mentioned customers, and I'm going to ask about demand. What do you see as far as a trend, or what do you see in the market on the consumer side that is driving innovation and development on the research and development side of the house at HP?
So I'd say that I see kind of three kind of big trends that then have an impact on where we focus our efforts. The first of those is kind of an increasing need to print locally. It's no longer really feasible to have only kind of large centralized production facilities. The rate of change and the number of orders that our customers receive, the level of customization and personalization that they have to do, as well as kind of environmental concerns and the cost of transportation, means that printing needs to move closer to where the print in the end is going to be used. Mm-hmm. This is really a very strong kind of factor. Then the second one is sort of a combination of increasing requirements of ever more content having to be printed to very high standards, very high degrees of accuracy, and even higher degrees of color consistency. And at the same time, the printing being done by either less and less skilled operators, or by people who have to do a great variety of things, one of which is to get the color right. So the days of having kind of dedicated color operators with long experience and extensive training, I don't think are with us for that much longer. Mm-hmm. And then the third kind of element is this need to be able to use a great variety of means for getting to the printed output. Changes in printing technology, materials like substrates have to be used to print the same content, and it has to have a certain level of consistency. And this is then also complemented with 3D printing. So you can think of examples where you may print some of the content on paper with aqueous inks, others with latex inks on a vinyl substrate, yet other cases may be 3D printed, and all of it has to look like it's coming from the same place.
What are some of the challenges that you see to make that happen in the area of color science, to make that product look the same regardless of where it's printed or printed locally, multiple locations, distributed manufacturing models, that kind of environment?
Mm-hmm. So my sense here, Jeff, is that I think there are some kind of basic challenges and gaps in terms of the science itself and our understanding of how we humans see color. But where I see kind of a more immediate challenge is in even making the science as we have it today be applied quickly at a reasonable cost and consistently. So what I mean by that is that even in cases where under laboratory conditions you can make things work, it's very difficult to take that and to make it easily usable by anyone.
So when you consider, when we look at today's labor force or our customers, there's definitely a difference in skill set or unskilled. Well, I don't want to say unskilled. That's not quite the right word, but we're in an environment where we need to have, or people want to have, a much easier way to operate the solutions, an easy button, if you will. And, you know, there's automation, there's a lot of things, but we still seem to we're not quite there as far as providing fluid, automated solutions that allow people to move on and do other things within the production process.
Yeah, so let me just pick up on one thing that you said, which I think is super important, which is that this is not about, you know, people not being skilled. I think it's a matter of, you know, even those who have the skills in, you know, getting color right, them having other priorities. So I think, for example, about photographers, and I think this is an example where, you know, we have a bit of a success story in at HP of bringing really easy color to this type of customer. And this is something that we've done, we've started kind of working on maybe 10, 12 years ago, when going to see this type of customer has invariably been, you know, a story of lots of challenges and difficulties, and having to invest a lot of time, having to bring in consultants to have color configured right, having them come in for a couple of days whenever the photographer wanted to use a new type of substrate. And we've been able to go from there to delivering a solution for them that where they only trigger a process that then does things that they don't need to know about, that they don't get asked about, but at the end of which you have accurate color profiles installed in the right places, in the operating system, in the applications, in the printer itself. And when it comes to printing, you then no longer need to think about what do I need to do to get the right colors, but it just comes out working correctly. Now, to do this, what we had to do a couple of things. We had to both make the core color profile building more robust to make it work well, even under kind of a broader variety of conditions than otherwise. We also had to work very closely with our customers to understand what it is that they expect to get. And we found here that their expectations were very consistent. So instead of having to provide a great variety of controls and adjustments and settings and choices, we could pre-cook for them a recipe that works, you know, for 80 or 90% of the cases. And with that kind of understanding of how they work and being able to pre-configure things for them, a process that previously required a consultant was now just one or two clicks away.
ID Alliance's Print Properties and Colormetric Council and other groups are now doing work on creating an intermediate exchange color space, and that's really to serve some of these wider format or wider gamut devices in digital printing. Do you have any thoughts on that? Have you taken a look at the use of that type of an approach to the gamuts of digital?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's definitely an interesting and a positive development. The more kind of standardization can be brought to bear on printing, and I think it's already happening a lot, thanks to the work that you guys are doing at ID Alliance, also others around the world are kind of really very active and making a big difference in putting standards in place. To my mind, I think there is always a case for the kind of two scenarios. One is I want to consistently get something that I can expect with a high degree of confidence, as against, in this particular case, I want to get the best possible result. So I think standardization clearly, you know, plays a very important and essential role in having predictability, repeatability, consistency, which is exactly what customers like brands are looking for. They want to get the same color regardless of where they get their content printed, whether it's in one place or another from one vendor or another. Then there are other kind of use cases, maybe more in the on the photography, fine art kind of end of the scale, where it's really about squeezing the most out of any particular printing system mm-hmm. and giving the best possible results. And I think these two things can kind of coexist quite well.
Are photographers and those in fine arts interested in reproducing more colors within the gamut, or do they find other things that are more important for their color reproduction in their images?
No, I wouldn't say that. Okay. In fact, it turns out that a lot of certainly kind of fine art photography is much more about things like control, subtlety, naturalness, balance, than about kind of really kind of impactful and great variety of colors. Although in some cases you may want it, and if you want it, then you want to have the option to use it.
Now, you mentioned the word balance and mm-hmm. Coming up in the trade long ago, it was always reinforced the term gray balance. And what mm-hmm. you know, what role does it play, and how important is it? Again, you know, we have G7, and of course we have System mm-hmm. Brunner and typical four color process, but an RGB and transmissive. Talk to us about the importance of gray, or maybe not so important.
Mm-hmm. So I think gray is really fundamental. It's the basis of everything else. So if you can't get grays right, then you know it almost doesn't matter how good or bad you are for other colors. And I think there are a couple of kind of aspects to this. And the first one, it reminds me of something that I heard in the context of graphic design, you know, where there is this saying, get it right in black and white. No? So when you're designing a logo or some layout, it has to work well in black and white. And then, you know, you can add color to it and it can be better, but it needs to work in black and white also. So this is kind of one piece to it. The other one also is that when we talk about gray neutrality, it's not necessarily a very kind of well-defined thing in general. And it reminds me of going to see a fine artist in Barcelona about 5 years ago, because we wanted to understand what preferences artists have for grays, for neutrals. And I took a bunch of prints with me with different choices of gray balance, and I showed them to this artist. And I said, you know, could you please take a look at these prints and tell me which one looks most neutral to you? And he looks at the prints and he turns to me and says, they're all pretty indifferent to me, so I'd say that they're all neutral, right? So what he meant is that so what neutrality meant to him was something completely different to, you know, what I wanted to kind of consult with him on, but it was still something that was important, even if it was interpreted in a very different way. And then kind of maybe the third angle to this, and maybe the one that's closer to, you know, what we kind of care about more specifically in printing, is the challenge that getting good neutrals brings with it, especially in this kind of multi-material, multi-viewing context. And here, things like the effect of optical brightening agents, the great variety of materials that we use in signage and also in textile in particular, mm-hmm. Make this a real challenge. It's challenging enough, you know, if we print with aqueous inks on paper, but the variety of textiles and also of plastics that we print on kind of multiply this challenge by several factors.
I wanted to touch on the subject of color on multiple substrates, including textiles, where brands are trying to accomplish what is seemingly impossible, and that is to match textiles or plastics or, you know, rigid plastics, for instance, as well as the packaging, whether it's plastic, flexo, or paper. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that and what you guys deal with at HP when those challenges are brought to you.
Yeah, this is a really kind of important topic for us, because in particular, a company like HP that has such a broad variety of printing products, we need to care about the big picture in terms of color communication. And one thing that we have done recently is we've gone back to some of our larger customers, some of the brands that we work with, and we've effectively try to become their apprentices again. And what we have done is we've kind of shadowed them and spent time with them, going through this whole process from the initial concept down to the final printed product on a shelf or installed in some place or worn by someone. Because we wanted to make sure that we look at this whole journey, not only at the point where the printing itself happens, but from beginning to end. Because we had this sense that there may be important places where having the printing stage well in mind would help the whole process. So to give you an example, and it's one that you've kind of sketched out already, Jeff, is this, let's take the example of printing a garment for some sporting event. This process really starts with some color scouts who will go around trying to get a feel for what color palettes, what color combinations are attractive, are popular, are relevant at any one moment. And what they will do is they'll talk to people, they'll try to understand the relevance of particular colors at a certain moment, and they'll end up with a palette that they will have built by collecting different objects. Let's say, I like the color of this feather or of this bottle top or this plastic or this leather or whatever other material. And they'll assemble this palette as a representation of color combinations from which then designers can start constructing designs. At this point, they will then, two things will start. One is a design process that takes this color palette and as an inspiration, as a guide, and will then create content such as patterns or other designs for a fabric. And in parallel with that, sort of a manufacturability investigation. So this collection of objects has certain colors. Can we actually make this happen in a fabric? Can we print this using the technologies that we have available? And these two things then kind of talk to each other, where design is influenced by what can be realized in practice, and it ends up in a colored design that is then ready for production. This then goes to both having some fabrics dyed, for example, and prints done onto those fabrics until then the final garment is assembled and delivered to its final destination. And so looking at this process, what we have seen really clearly is that that color plays a really important role throughout this process, the initial scouting, the design, the production, etc. But that color is the expectations for color vary along this process. At first, it's very, very unconstrained. You're just looking for colors that look good together.
Yeah.
Then also, when it comes to the design stage, what you want is that any prototypes or proofs or validation prints or anything you create during this process gives you the right impression. When you look at it, you want to have the same impression you'll have from looking at the final garment. But you're not concerned about whether it's 1, 2, 3 or more delta E's away, as long as it gives you the right impression. When it then comes to manufacturing, in textile manufacturing, you'll be looking for very high degrees of match, of below 1 delta E CMC, under a variety of lighting conditions. And you'll want to be getting that level of match to some reference, and also to maintain that in terms of consistency over a production run. In kind of printing onto these fabrics, instead the requirements are more relaxed in terms of the matching, given that the level of match that is possible with the systems available today has its limitations. But the requirements then for consistency are very high. And again, they are around the 1 delta E 2000 level. So very different levels of expectations, but kind of a single story, a single case of continuity of color running from the very beginning to the end of the process.
So one delta E seems seemingly impossible when we consider all of the variables that happen in the process, and that is, you know, the production equipment, the presses, the printers. Then we have the instruments, and they have inherent variability. And so that starts to stack up and becomes a problem to manage a one delta E request from a brand owner. So consultants and manufacturers, the problem solvers that are trying to accomplish the request of a one delta E or a two delta E or below from a brand owner, what's the best way to approach that? What's behind the, how do we communicate it? Is it just to be transparent? It's seemingly impossible to do considering all the variables that can affect that delta E.
This is a great question. And in fact, when I looked at this recently, and I was asked whether it's possible to do this, to get consistently to below one delta E, my first reaction was no, that it's not really possible to do that, precisely for the reasons that you mentioned: the instrument themselves, the variation in the materials, whatever hardware is involved in the process, whether it prints or measures. You know, everything varies, and it very quickly stacks up. So I went into this question exactly, from the point that you mentioned. Then I would make a distinction between two different things. One is whether it's possible to get to a match to a given reference to within a one delta E, and the other is whether once a system is set up to whatever level of match it has achieved, to maintain consistency to within one delta E. Because I think these two things are quite different, right? Mm-hmm. And I think they're quite different for an important reason, which is that if you think about a system that has many components, each of which can vary, each of which affect color, and all of those components vary randomly and in different directions, then very quickly you'll run out of budget if you have one delta E. But if instead you have a system that's set up to give a certain output, to maintain it consistently, the changes are not random and all over the place. There is some level of consistency happening in terms of change as well. And keeping that below a certain level of color difference is an easier task in principle than the initial match. So whether this is something that's possible or should even be the aim, I think whether it should be the aim or not depends very much on the application. So if I think about general purpose graphics production, one delta E is overkill. It's entirely unnecessary because most of the time it will not even be perceived. The kind of perceptibility threshold for typical kind of photographic image content is way above one delta E. Depending on how you kind of compute it, it's maybe at 2.5 delta E. And this is also well reflected in the standards for the graphic arts. And in this case, I think it's entirely unnecessary and doesn't really bring much value to operate to these much tighter tolerances. Now, there are other applications, though, such as tiling, which in particular for our latex printers we face very, very consistently, where one delta E is really what is required. Right. So think about... Mm-hmm. Think about a case where you are assembling a display, you're putting together a wall at some exhibition or convention. That's the result of putting together, I don't know, 6 or 8 tiles. And these tiles are placed immediately next to each other, and they need to form a single print. If in this scenario you have color differences that exceed one delta E, you will see it as banding over the whole print.
Yes.
And talking to our customers, their expectation is not to see any differences. And we've seen that it really does translate to not exceeding 1 or maybe 1.2, 1.3 delta E, but being really close to 1 delta E. And then here, I know that it is possible to get to this level of consistency, and it takes a couple of things. It takes having a printer calibrated well with a spectrophotometer, having custom ICC profiles built for that printer, and using it in a in a print mode, so at a printing speed that is consistent enough to remain below 1 delta E. And it's possible to do this, and we have customers who even in high volume production environments can get to this level of consistency.
Jan, I'd like to ask you about the article you recently published on color constancy in humans and bees. It's a very interesting piece, and I would love to share that with our listeners, if that's okay.
Yeah, certainly. So this is really a bit of a side project, and it's the result of having attended some kind of interdisciplinary science events in the past, and talking to people from very different disciplines, from paleontology, chemistry, geology, biology. One thing kind of struck us, which is that if you look at nature, it has got a fundamentally kind of relational character. No matter how you look at the world around us, it tends to boil down to how things relate to each other, as opposed to how something is by itself. And this is something that I also see very broadly in color. And the article I wrote was to pick out a particular aspect of how this importance of relationships of in nature demonstrates itself when it comes to color vision. Mm-hmm. And I looked at color constancy, which is about... which is to do with the fact that when we look at the world around us, the color of objects tends to be broadly constant or unchanging, even if the lighting conditions change. So whether you're looking at something at sunrise or at midday, whether the sky is overcast or not, it tends to have broadly the same color. And even if its color changes, if you kind of pay close attention to what things look like, you will notice that they do change over the course of a day. We are still able to tell what color the object itself has. And this is something that is surprising, you know, if you think more closely about it, because there's a basic ambiguity in the way that objects appear. And if you think about a very simple example, so imagine having a white surface that's lit by red light, or a red surface that's lit by white light. Mm-hmm. Both of these will look exactly the same. They will just look red. And if all you are looking at is this one surface, you cannot tell whether it's a red surface under white light or a white surface under red light. Now, clearly, when we look around us, we can tell, you know, what color things have. And it turns out that this is because our eyes, and then the way that our brains process the signals from our eyes, they take advantage of the fact that we almost always see a great variety of objects around us. And if we look at how the signals from each of these objects relate to each other, and if we take advantage, therefore, of the relationship of those signals, we find that it's those relationships that are constant and that remain more or less unchanged as you go from light of one color to another. And given that I was kind of interested in whether this is something that holds more broadly in nature, or whether it's something that's only our human visual systems have evolved to do, I came across some papers that describe the same kind of behavior in bees. And in fact, the first of those was from something like 1914, where a German scientist has set up an experiment trying to work out whether bees can or cannot kind of take away the effect of the color of lighting. And what they have done is they've made up a little chart of different colored surfaces, some yellow, some gray, some mm-hmm. mixed combinations of yellow and gray. They placed sugar on the yellow squares. And then when they showed them to bees, they found the yellow squares, which are like the color of the flowers that they would normally collect pollen from. And they were able to do the task normally. Then next, what they did is they lit the same square through a colored filter. And now clearly the actual physics of the light reflected from each of those squares changed completely, but bees were still able to find the yellow squares, and they were not confused even if the filter was yellow, and therefore the actual gray squares mm-hmm. physically were more like the yellow ones from regular daylight. So this is I really like this because it's quite an ingenious experiment to work out how bees see the world around them. And it turns out that they also, you know, are very much based on this idea of looking for relationships among the things that they view.
You know, what else really drives you and what brings you value other than the obvious, which is problem solving?
Wow, that's a great question. So for me, really, the most motivating thing is to work with others, and both the joy and the enrichment that follows from working with others and trying to solve problems together. And this has been really, you know, the most exciting and the most enjoyable thing about my work. So if I think about, you know, these last years, what stands out to me is not so much at all this invention or that or this patent or that, but, you know, having worked with one person or another for a certain number of years, and both the friendship and the relationship that develops over the time, and also that then leading to making new discoveries, to developing new solutions together. It's always much more exciting and interesting to do something, you know, with a friend than to try and be the one who does things by themselves.
Wow, that's a fantastic message. And thank you so much for sharing your story with us today on the Gamut Podcast, Jan. And I hope to have you on again.
And thank you very much for the invitation again, Jeff. It'll be a pleasure to do this again. Anytime it suits you, let me know. And I hope it's been interesting for your listeners as well.
Thanks for listening to the Gamut Podcast. If you have ideas, suggestions, or would like to join us or even sponsor future podcasts, simply email me at jcollins@idealliance.org. That's jcollins@idealliance.org. Take care and have a productive day.